When that happens, he flees, goes to his home, basically is rescued or let out the window by his wife when Saul's servants come to find him. And then from there, he starts going to various places. He then from there goes to Naoth and Ramah, where he goes to Samuel. He'll then flee from there and go to Jonathan, which probably was in Gibeah. There you see just below that. And then to Nob, where Ahimelech the priest is. Again, that's where he has no food, he has no weapons or anything. So for the men that are with him, the priest gives them showbread, and then he has the sword that belonged to Goliath. And then from there he goes to the city of Gath, and he fears for his life and he feigns insanity in order to escape that situation. And then we'll finally flee to the stronghold in Adullam. And here's where he starts to have people come to him that are in debt, that are unhappy with the kingdom. And so he starts to collect attract men, and 400 men that he attracts there, becomes a captain over them. He finds a place in Moab, and specifically Mizpah, which I think fell off the map there, for his parents to stay, because again he fears for their safety as well, because Saul is trying to kill him, and he fears for his parents. He's told to return to the land of Judah through the prophet Gad. He goes to the city of Keilah, and there he inquires of God, and he goes there because the city is being overrun by the Philistines, and so he saves the city. But at the same time, he becomes in fear for his life when Saul finds out he's there. And so, again, he inquires of God, and he's told to flee Keilah. From there, he goes to the strongholds in the wilderness of Ziph. And this is where the Ziphites will offer up David, tell Saul that he's there. And so Saul tells them to go and make sure of where he is, and then come back and give him word. And when they do, he's then gone down to the wilderness of Maon. And then you have a situation where Saul and his men are on one side of a mountain, David and his men are on the other side of the mountain. And then Saul gets word that the Philistines have now started to attack, so he has to go back to his city. And that, again, essentially saves David in that situation. And then he flees to the strongholds of En-Gedi, and this is really where David spares Saul's life for the first time, as they are in the same cave. And basically he cuts off part of Saul's robe, and it says he even feels guilty about doing that. And then he confronts Saul with the evidence, accuses him of listening to men that have lied about David, and then uses part of his robe as evidence that God had delivered Saul into his hand, but he did not harm Saul. And then Saul recognizes his wickedness. He recognizes David's righteousness, and swears that he won't harm, but more importantly, he asked David that he would not harm Saul's family, which was kind of interesting because Saul wasn't really in a position to be bargaining there. But nonetheless, he asked David to swear that he will not destroy Saul's family after his reign's over. And so they depart ways at that point. And then David sends his men to Carmel, which is not the mount, it's a town, because he sends his men to Nabal, whom his men had helped in the past as he was shepherding his flocks and to get food. And basically they are treated very badly by Nabal, who says, "Who is David and why should I help him?" And there's a lot of servants who are running away from their masters these days. And so word gets back to David. He says, "Everybody put on your spear," and he goes to take his vengeance against Nabal. And this is where, this is two things we didn't have time for 2 weeks ago, but this is where we get introduced to Abigail. And it talks about Abigail as being not just a beautiful woman, but also a wise woman. And again, the whole chapter there gives details about what she did to basically prevent David from taking vengeance on her husband. And she tries to take full responsibility for what he's done. She recognizes that her husband is not a wise man and admits to that to David. What's interesting here is her appeal to David is in the context of his victory over his enemy. She references Saul seeking David's life and then God's protection. And then it's in verse 29 of chapter 25, she references David's victory by saying, "He shall sling out as from the pocket of a sling." And I thought the imagery there was very interesting, because that might obviously refer to him defeating Goliath. And so she makes reference to that. But what's most interesting is in verses 30 and 31 of chapter 25, where she puts that event in the context of David's impending kingdom. And she basically makes the case that by restraining his hand now, he will not have regrets in the future. And then she requests of David, his protection when he becomes king. And of course, David can see the wisdom of this woman who has come to him. And again, she didn't come empty-handed. It gave a long list of food and supplies that she was bringing with her. Obviously, a lot of the things that David has sent his men to go ask for in the first place. What I like about that account is how it talks about she gathers all these things and sends them ahead with her servants before she reaches David. And that sort of reminds me of Jacob when he's going to be reunited with Esau. And again, he sends all these gifts ahead of him with the thought of maybe I can placate my brother and things will go well. And so again, a spirit of humility on the part of Abigail. So he praises Abigail. He recognizes in verses 32 and 33 that God has sent her to him to keep him from sinning, and accepts her gift and stands down in his desired revenge. And so after that account, we have where he goes back to the wilderness of Ziph. And this is the second time that he spares Saul's life. And in this situation, with one of his men, go into Saul's camp. They are asleep. And he goes and basically takes the water jug and the sword that is by Saul's head. And then they sneak out, and then he calls out to Abner, who is supposed to guard the king, and makes the case to him that he's failed in his duty to do so. But what's interesting in this appeal to Saul that he makes this second time, as he says in verses 19 and 20, if the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. So the idea being that this persecution is because of the distressing spirit that Saul is experiencing, or the consequence of that, then he advises him to make a sacrifice to God. But he says, if it is the children of men, then let them be accursed. Again, going back to a similar statement he made before, where you are listening to people who are lying to you about me, that David is not trying to harm Saul. It's actually the other way around. And in this case, in verse 21 of chapter 26, Saul's response is a bit more contrite. He admits he has sinned. He says, I've rewarded you with evil. And then he promises not to harm David anymore. And David's response to that is to remind Saul that it was God who delivered him into his hand, Saul into his hand, and then he appeals to God for protection. He doesn't appeal to Saul, even though Saul has promised he won't harm David, but rather his confidence is in God. He makes that clear in verse 24. And at that point, both men part ways, and this chase sort of seems to come to an end. However, the next chapter talks about how then David goes back to Gath. So clearly, David did not feel all that secure enough in Saul's promise to believe that his life was no longer in danger. And so he flees back to the land of the Philistines, and specifically to Achish, the king of Gath. And what's interesting is, we saw this once before in chapter 21, but what's different about this time when you think about Saul now in the beginning of chapter 27? As he goes to the Philistine land of Gath, what's different about this time as he's approaching Achish? First, he's not alone like he was before. So he's got, again, a number of men that have aligned with him. And then we also know from the chapter that they apparently have more knowledge now of the enmity that is between Saul and David. They also know about the great things that the Israelites have said about David, and that will come up a little bit later in chapter 9. But then David makes an interesting request. He makes a request to go reside in a different town than in the royal city. So the king gives him the city of Ziklag. There's some question as to what the location of that town is. But basically, his whole purpose for doing this, obviously, is to get away from Saul, to get out of the land of Israel, that he can be essentially aligned to the, he can be in the land of the Philistines, so that Saul would not go in that territory and pursue him, and that works. His strategy works from verse 4. One item that's interesting to note on this from Barnes, it says likely the request for him to have a different town than the royal city is likely a
an attempt to keep a low profile. It says, David suggests as a reason for leaving Gath that his presence was burdensome and expensive to the king. His real motive was to be more out of the way of observation and control so as to act the part of an enemy of Saul without really lifting up his hand against him and his own countrymen of Israel. And we'll see this come into play a little bit later, as when the Philistines muster to go to war with the Israelites, the situation that puts David into, and then suspicions that Achish's own men have of David. The last thing we kind of see here is not necessarily from this passage, but again, look, we're now at the point where we're starting to look at corresponding passages in 1 Chronicles, is the mighty men that continue to join David during this time, and they're during different periods of time as we're going through these accounts, but it lists there 23 men who are sons of Benjamin, which again was Saul's own tribe, as well as sons of Gad and Manasseh, who would have been from the other side of the Jordan. So, as he goes to Gath and he aligns himself with Achish, again to flee from Saul and to have some protection, what is his relationship with the king of Gath, as it's described in chapter 27, and how does David maintain that relationship? Maybe arrangement.
Yeah, maybe arrangement.
More like arrangement. Off on raids to the surrounding areas to, it says, the Geshurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites. And as well as Achish being convinced that David is loyal to him and that he has sort of turned his back on his country, he's also equally convinced that his own countrymen have turned their back on David. And it, obviously the enmity that Saul and his kingdom had. So he goes off on these raids, and there's sort of this narrative in there. He comes back from raids, and Achish says, well, where have you gone today? And he sort of gives a report on, here's the areas I've gone, and raid it, and there would be spoil, and from that you would expect, and sort of the implication is that he is helping to sort of enrich Achish as a result of that. There's something in particular, though, it mentions about when David goes off and goes on these raids that he does. That is interesting. It points out in terms of when he goes to these towns, what does he take? What does he not let?
He kills
everybody. Kills the men, the women, you know, and he keeps the oxen and the animals, and again, the spoils of the war that he would obviously bring back. But why does it say he kills all the men and women? There'd be no witnesses, lest they would come back and say, thus, this is what David did. And so again, there was this desire to make sure that, you know, he is protected from Saul by being in this region, but at the same time, he is still loyal to Israel, obviously. He has been anointed king, future king of Israel, and so he has to be careful here in terms of what he's doing. The arrangement, I think probably the word arrangement is better than the word relationship, again, is sort of symbiotic between the two of them. I've mentioned before one of the good books about just the United Kingdom in general is the Waldron's book, Give Us a King, and they comment that David did not allow any men or women to survive his raids so that they could not potentially inform Gath of his deceit. And again, they base that on chapter 27, verse 11. Because these southern tribes, the ones he references in this chapter, the Jerahmeelites and the Kenites, were also allies of the Philistines. So the thought there is that David was basically preparing for that time when he would be king and basically was sort of taking care of the enemies on the southern border and using that as an opportunity
to sort of take care of that in advance of his kingdom. So as a result of all this, Achish, of course, believes that he's loyal. And in the beginning of chapter 28, first couple of verses, the arrangement changes a little bit in that now the Philistines muster for war against Israel, starting in chapter 28, and he proposes to David that he and his men go out to battle with him against Israel. David concurs, kind of references his previous raids, that you know what your servant can do. And then it says Achish makes David captain of his bodyguard. Now that's interesting because sort of in his responsibility, if his job, if he and his men is to protect Achish, then he would sort of be in the rear of the formation. And I think when you look in chapter 29, and as they start coming out in formation, it's clear that David and his men are sort of following the rear of the guard. So that would be where they would be in terms of gathering for battle. So then going into chapter 28, it then sort of breaks away and now comes back to Saul, beginning in verse 3 of chapter 28. And we talked about all this. The purpose of this map was just kind of show you where those tribes were, those people were, that David would go on the raid. And we discussed this. So they're gathering for battle, and what's interesting about this is where it shows when they gather at Aphek, again, they're sort of moving north. There's some thoughts eventually to obviously be within the Valley of Jezreel, that you see near the top, and Mount Gilboa, where the Israelites gather for battle. And there's different thoughts as to why this moves as far north as it does. But beginning in verse 4 of chapter 28 is where we again pick up Saul, and it talks about him going to a medium or a witch at Endor. So what causes Saul to do this, and what do his actions kind of say about this point in his life in terms of his spiritual condition and especially his ability to lead Israel at this point? Fearful of the Philistines, he sees them mustering for war. Again, similar to what we've seen in the previous chapters, where I think it's chapter 13 again, where he sees them gather and he doesn't really know what to do, and that's where he goes ahead and offers the burnt offering after waiting for Samuel. As Mike said, he prays to God or inquires of God, and God is silent. And so it's really, the word that comes to mind is desperation. And so he tells his men to find a medium that he can go to, which is interesting. Why?
Why?
That's coming from, this request or command is coming from him. He's the one that ran them all out. I mean, it makes reference to the very beginning of chapter 28. Well, it was the beginning of chapter 25 was where we read about the death of Samuel, but it references the death of Samuel again. And then we think sometime around then, he runs out all the mediums and the spiritists, and so now he's saying, find me a medium. And so they have to go to Endor. They have to disguise themselves. He goes with two other men by night. And so it's a moment of desperation where he has called out to God, and God did not answer. And so he goes to the medium. He requests her to bring up Samuel. And what happens next? She does it. She clearly sees something. And what's very clear from the passage is that there's no mistake. What's interesting is she seems to immediately know that she's been deceived, that she's been lied to, because she immediately identifies Saul, and she's very fearful for her life. When the request is made, she's immediately fearful for her life because she references the fact that what this person is requesting, you know, Saul has ran out all the mediums. So why are you putting my life in danger like this? And so now she discovers, obviously from what she saw in the spirit of Samuel coming up, that this is actually Saul. There's an interesting phrase that's used in verse 7 where New King James Version says where Saul has said, find me a woman who is a medium. Other passages or translations, I think the American Standard being one, uses the term familiar spirit. You know, find me a woman who has a familiar spirit. That's sometimes translated, and again, this is from the God Give Us a King book,
is sometimes translated as leather bag or stomach, and that's because the mediums were viewed as being a ventriloquist. She would pretend to have a spirit in the realm of the dead with whom she was on familiar or good terms, and though she could not talk freely with the dead herself, her familiar spirit would or could. So the thought was through it, she could talk to any dead person that she wished. Of course, all of this was pretense. It was all kind of an act. And so she would pretend to be essentially channeling this dead spirit through her. Clearly, when Samuel comes up, this is not a case of an act given her reaction. But what is the other evidence that we have that this isn't an act? It's in the Bible, but specifically, what message comes as a result of this to Saul? Excuse me? He tells Saul that he and his sons will die the next day, that this time tomorrow you will be with me, meaning you'll be dead. He tells him why. You know, why is all this happening? Why is it that God is not speaking to him when he inquires? He calls it that the Lord has become an enemy of Saul, exactly. And then it references one event that goes back to how when this all kind of started. Amalek. Going back to the fact that he had a command to go utterly destroy the Amalekites and he didn't do it in chapter 15. And because of that, it traces back to this is now the kingdom has been torn away from you. And you remember when that happened, that he'd reached out and grabbed Samuel and ripped his garment. And he said, symbolically, in the same way, God has ripped away the kingdom from you and given it to another. And so the fact that this information is given as a result would obviously show that this was really Samuel. When you think of the desperation that Saul is in at this point, one reference here that I found interesting from Shipwrecks of Faith by Dr. Richard Trench. It says, all human history has failed to record a despair deeper or more tragic than his, who, having forsaken God and being of God forsaken, is now seeking to move hell, and infinitely guilty as he is, assuredly there is something utterly pathetic in that yearning of the disanointed king to change words with the friend and counselor of his youth, and if he must hear his doom, to hear it from no other lips but his. Again, you can't imagine that, you know, where he is at in life, that it's come down to this, but it goes to show that as you look at the progression of his life and you see Saul as king, it goes back to what we said in the very beginning. It comes down to his character and how his view of what it meant to obey God. And what I mean by that is we certainly see a contrast between Saul and David, to where with David, the enduring quality and character is that he constantly would inquire of God. When he was not sure, he would seek out God's guidance. God's will was his desire. And the only times he really gets in trouble in his life is when he doesn't do that. And Saul, on the other hand, it seems to be the obedience is there if it's in accordance with what he desires. And so, again, goes back to sort of as you see at the very beginning of Saul's life, here was a man that was head and shoulders above the rest. He was attractive. He had all the physical appearances of what the people would expect in the king. But when it came to his heart, it wasn't aligned to God's will, as we certainly see in the case of David. So, anything else on that we want to cover before we move on?
David is his own health, belief in God, and not favor, and gift. Things that he is forced to do.
clearly when men are not following God's will. And what's interesting is that it's not a mystery as to what's going to happen either. Saul knows. He admits the second time that David spares his life. He recognizes David will be king. When Jonathan comes to David to encourage him, part of that encouragement is he admits that David's going to be king, and he goes, even my father Saul knows this. So there wasn't a mystery as to what was going to happen. Everybody knew what the conclusion of the matter was, and yet we don't, you know, what we see out of Saul to the bitter end is, again, that refusal to be obedient. And again, it strikes a huge contrast. As far as his ability to lead Israel at this point, you know, it talks about after he hears these words from the medium, which are from Saul, from Samuel, you know, he falls on the ground. He's dreadfully afraid, refuses to eat, and it takes the medium and the men to convince him to even eat anything. But basically, his ability to lead, he's paralyzed with fear and dread. He now has been told he's going to die the next day. And, you know, lessons for us in this, you know, you look at a situation like this, you think, well, my goodness, how in the world could something get that desperate and that apart from God, and that would never, you know, it never would get like that. It doesn't start out that way. It starts out with iterative steps in departing from God. And again, we see that in the life of Saul as his character comes out, and I would say his heart comes out, because again, it goes back to, you know, qualities that appear to be externally attractive will not have staying power if one's heart's not aligned to God's will. Again, it goes back to this contrast that was even within Saul himself. And then the last line there again, that I think is a good summation of what his leadership philosophy was when it came to his relationship with God. So that goes into chapter 29. Where, again, going back to the Philistines and to where David is in Gath, and as they're mustering for battle in Aphek, the lords of the Philistines have an objection to David being there. As the troops are sort of in formation, the question is, what are these Hebrews doing here? And what is their objection as far as David and his men being there? It's kind of obvious, but I know David. And they might turn on, they can quote by heart what the praise was from the women who sang Saul and David's praises. Okay? They're obviously worried that he would turn on the Philistines, and it's specifically that they make the case that the only way that he can reconcile himself to his master Saul is by taking our heads. And so it's a very logical argument. What's another reason why you think they would be suspicious here? He's an Israelite. He clearly has shown his ability to go raid other places. He's a fighter. He's a warrior. So if he can use that against our enemies, he can just as easily use it against us. Who else has he demonstrated that capability against, going back to what the women had said? Goliath. Where was Goliath from? He's a Philistine from Gath. And so, you know, part of when you go back and think of chapter 21, you know, when he flees first to Gath, and he gets fearful for his life, because in part he's kind of obviously recognized, and he feigns insanity. Again, he's going to the hometown of the champion that he killed by the power of God. And so I think, again, it just goes to show the desperation that he has in terms of fleeing for his life from Saul. Because again, we tend to look at this as he went here, then he went there, then he went there. He is running for his life. And when you look at where he goes, he's running out of places. He can't go home to his wife. He can't go to his mentor, the prophet Samuel. He wouldn't want to go to Bethlehem, to his hometown. He's even got to get his parents away from there and move them to another country. And so, really, what's left is to align himself to the enemy for a time to save his own life. But even there, he's got to play it careful because he has defeated them in the past. Okay? So given this moment in Israel's history, so the Lord's the Philistines basically, you know, push against Achish and said, no, he is not going to go to battle with us. And so what does Achish then tell him to do? Leave the front, go in peace, go back to your place, or return to your place, which would have been Ziklag, the town that he had been given. And how do you think the providence of God is kind of seen in that, in the context of where he is in his life, as well as what's coming up, though, in the next chapter, in chapter 30? So he was able, and they didn't have to fight. So part of it is from chapter 30. He's basically able to go back to Ziklag. I think it's 3 days later they get there, and of course the city has been burned. The wives and the families have all been taken away by the Amalekites. So they're able to obviously go and rescue them. And again, David inquires of God before doing it. But the other thing is, if he stays there, he's got a choice between two bad choices, which is fighting against his country or lying to Achish and then turning around and betraying him. So again, there's, I think in this you still see the protection that God has, obviously, in for David, but it happens for a reason, I guess is what I'm trying to say, is the way it plays out in chapter 30. Okay, so going to chapter 30, we kind of already covered this, but when he returns, the city's been burned, women and children have been taken, and so he leaves, and it says he strengthened himself in the Lord, because as soon as this happens, David and all of his men weep, and this really gets to a very pivotal moment with David and his men, because what do his men want to do? They want to stone him. There's so much sorrow and there's so much anger that now they want to stone David. And it, when he's in this situation, it says he strengthens himself in the Lord. So again, confidence was in God. It was not in himself. It was not even in his men. And so he inquires of God to see if they should go ahead and pursue the Amalekites. He says, yes, they do. They reach a brook called Bezor. They leave 200 of the men there. Because they're too tired to go on, and he pursues with the remaining 400 men. They find an Egyptian slave who had been cast off from an Amalekite because the Egyptian slave had fell ill. He basically says, can you take us to the camp of where they're at? He says, yes, I will, on the condition that let my life be spared. Don't take my life and don't turn me over to my Amalekite master, because obviously that would have resulted in his death as well. So he gets all this out of them, out of giving him bread and water, because he hadn't eaten or drank anything for 3 days and three nights. And so they agree. He takes them to the camp. They're obviously enjoying the spoil of the war. And so they attack the camp, and it says only 400 Amalekites escape on camels. So he recovers all of his wives. He had two wives, not all of his wives, but all of his wives, all of his goods. And it also says there were some additional goods that the Amalekites had from previous spoils in verse 20. That then get divvied out. When they get divvied out, there's something that happens that shows some qualities of leadership with David. How does his handling of the spoil kind of show his leadership among the people? When they start heading back to Ziklag, they obviously stopped at Bezor, that brook where they left 200 people. And what happens there? So the 400 that went with him say, we don't think the 200 should get anything because they didn't go with us, other than give them back their wives and their families, give back the things that have been taken away from them, but all these other spoils we got, they didn't go fight. And there's also the implication there that you know, they, not only should they not have the spoil, but they should lead them away and depart. It seems to imply there's sort of a separation there, but just let them go their own way. What's interesting is, how does it describe these men of these 400 that were pushing for this? Wicked men, and what was the other? Worthless. Wicked and worthless men. And when you look at that phrase, the same phrase, I believe, appears in chapter 10 and verse 27, which it's also rendered men of Belial. Wicked and worthless men. Those men there were the ones who spoke against Saul and said, how can this one lead us? And you'll recall that when they come back from... I'm giving something away, but they come back from delivering Jabesh-Gilead from the Ammonites, and the people react and respond and say, well, who were those people who said, how can Saul lead us? Let's put them to death. And Saul said, no, nobody's going to die today. So David has, again, men of Belial in his army that speak against these other 200, and his response is, no, we are going to share the spoils of the battle, and that the one who goes and fights the battle, whether they fight the battle, whether they stay back behind with the equipment, they have part. And it says he made it a statute throughout his kingdom from that day forward. And he did one other thing after that. What else did he do with the spoil? Sent some to the elders of Judah and a list of a bunch of cities he sent those out to. And again, this would obviously be in recognition of these are places he probably... where they harbored him and kept him safe. So he was something of a repayment of recognition of that, but also with the knowledge that, again, he was going to be king of Israel, and going back to the desire for it to be one united kingdom, again, he is sharing the spoil with the elders of Judah. As far as the qualities, again, we've already kind of addressed these. What I find interesting is he shows... this type of leadership and example to men who not that long ago had wanted to stone him. His reliance on God is incredible. And again, we kind of pointed this out 2 weeks ago more in the lesson, where we were able to go back and look at a lot of the Psalms and kind of see Psalms that were written during that time period where David is fleeing, and you can see the emotion and the energy that he pours into appealing to God. And so again, it goes back to him being truly a man after God's own heart and seeking His will in all things. So the Philistines are camped in Aphek. They fight against Israel. Israel's on Mount Gilboa. And again, this is the last chapter of the book, where they pursue Saul, kill him and his three sons on Gilboa. I shouldn't say they kill Saul. They reach him and wound him. Okay. And so when they wound him, he makes a request of his armor bearer. How does his choice of death at this point sort of inform his character as he reaches the end of his life? So, he requests of his armor bearer to do what? To kill him. The armor bearer doesn't want to do it. He's obviously fearful of putting his hand against the Lord's anointed. And so he falls on his own sword. Armor bearer sees that he's dead, and the armor bearer takes his own life as well. And then we have, and again, what is the reason why he chose to do that? One of the reasons he chose to do that. What's his fear in terms of about to die? He's worried about what the Philistines would do to him. And it turns out they did it to him anyway. So the Philistines find him, and what do? Cut off his head, hang his body up in one of the cities, and take his armor. Why do you think they would have done that? Does that sound familiar? Spoils of war, and show other nations, probably instill fear. What had David done to Goliath? Cut off his head. Where was his sword? Well, it was with him now, but it was in Nob. He found it in Nob. So it had been, displayed or at some point stored or kept for a reason. So again, kind of a counterpart to what had been done to them. So Samuel's prophecy comes true.
And again, this kind of obviously informs Saul's character. I asked about the contrast with Judges chapter 16 there. Because what's interesting is Samson, as he reaches the end of his life, he's a judge. He's fighting the Philistines, much different end. You know, what does he pray to God as he is standing against two pillars? Prays for strength. Lord, let me die with the Philistines. He's incapacitated because his eyes have been punched out. And he has lost his strength. He's asking for strength for this one last moment of deliverance where he can fight against the Philistines. So again, where Saul is at in his life and his decisions at this point really go to show how far from God that he was. And again, the sadness of that kind of the end of his life. The men of Jabesh come and rescue Saul's body and that of his sons. They go and burn the bodies. They bury the bones. Why do you think they would have done that?
What's that?
He rescued them. Okay, so when the Ammonites had come previously and threatened their city, it was Saul who brought, obviously as king, who brought all the people together to rescue him. In 1 Chronicles chapter 10, verses 13 and 14, it's to me an interesting epitaph of Saul's life, where it talks about Saul died for his unfaithfulness, which he committed against the Lord, because he did not keep the word of the Lord, and also because he consulted a medium for guidance. But he did not inquire of the Lord, therefore he killed him and turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Jesse. We then get into chapter 2 Samuel chapter 1, and real quickly, a man escapes from the camp, or comes from the camp of the Israelites, gives David the news that Saul and his sons had been killed. And David asks an interesting question: how do you know? And he says, well, I know because I came by, I saw Saul on his spear, but the life had not left him yet. He asked me to kill him, so I did. And what is David's response?
Bad move.
How were you not afraid to touch the Lord's anointed? Here, he had two opportunities to do it, and he didn't do it. And so he has his men kill this man. And this man is who? We don't have a name, but... What's that? He was an Amalekite. So another touch of irony there. Now, the problem is that contradicts what we read in chapter 31 of 1 Samuel, verses 4 through 6. Because it does say that Saul fell on his own sword and he died, or at least the armor bearer certainly saw that he was dead when he killed himself. So the thought here is that he may have probably already found Saul dead. He certainly took his crown. He took the bracelet to deliver and bring to David. It's clear from what he says to David, he thinks he's doing the right thing. He thinks this is going to be pleasing to David. He certainly didn't think he was going to die as a result of it. So this might have been a way for him to kind of curry favor for who he knew was going to be the next king, and it didn't quite work out that way. And then, of course, we see the song of lament that David writes over Saul and Jonathan. I can't believe we actually got through every single question. That's a first. Thank you.